Right, welcome comrades and friends. Today we've got a day school with actually three talks are going to happen. And the first one's going to be Rob Worden is going to give a talk on Israel, the Intifada and the peace process. He'll speak for about half an hour and then we'll have a questions and discussion at the end. Okay, over to you, Rob.
Thanks, Steph. The title of what I'm going to talk about today is Israel, the Intifada and the peace process towards a no-state solution. Basically, what I'm not going to do is give a kind of potted A-level rehash of the chronology of what's going on in Israel and the Middle East since 1948. For various reasons, I don't think that's entirely useful. I think most of you all probably know quite a bit of what I talk about anyway. And I think there are other sort of deeper points of analysis that I'd prefer to get onto. Instead, what I'm going to talk about is going to be grouped into three broad headings. First of all, I want to talk about the peace process and the new Intifada. I'm going to take that as my starting point. Secondly, I'm going to briefly cover what some of the major leftist groups say about the situation in Israel. This isn't just navel-gazing, because this has very important implications on not only what they say, what they advocate in the area, and indeed the actions that they take. Those of us who were on the anti-war march last week no doubt will have seen on the organisers' placards not only the phrase, you know, no war in Iraq, but the tagline underneath, freedom for Palestine. This isn't a coincidence. This is actually part of the theory of the Socialist Workers' Party and whatever. And so, like I say, it does have implications. So I'll be covering some of what other leftist groups says. Lastly, I want to sort of try to begin to work out some sort of position for us in the World Socialist Movement to take on this conflict and what we should say about the region in general. Well, the current Intifada, which of course means uprising, began in October 2000. It was triggered by a visit to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem by Ariel Sharon. Sharon was then an opposition MP, he is now, of course, the Prime Minister of Israel. Why did this trigger off a generalised uprising in the occupied territories? Well, what I'm going to argue is that it's symptomatic of the breakdown of the so-called peace process on both the Israeli and the Palestinian side of the conflict. So what do we mean by that? Well, first of all, this goes back to what we termed the peace process. They began with the Oslo Accords in 1993, which were to be signed between the Israeli state, the American guarantors, and basically the PLO, emerging under the guise of the Palestinian Authority. Some people, such as Noam Chomsky, basically correctly say that what this is was a move to legitimately depossess the Palestinians even further. The stated aim, of course, is to create a Palestinian state. I think that's problematical. I think that's highly problematical. If you're talking about a fully functioning democratic state, which is supposed to be the stated aims, I think that's absolute nonsense. I think that's unworkable. But at the same time, the peace process isn't just that. It's not just about the dispossession of the Palestinians within that area. So what is it? That begs the question, what is this peace process? Well, first of all, it's an acknowledgement on the part of a faction within the Israeli bourgeoisie, basically the Labour establishment. As you probably know, the Israeli Labour Party ruled in Israel uninterrupted from 1948 until 1977. Just about all the famous political figures from the past and from that period in Israel were members of the Labour Party, people like David Ben-Gurion, Golda Meir, and so on and so forth. They've realised by now, after the uprisings in the 80s and the situation that they were faced with in the beginning of the 90s, that the occupied territories were getting pretty much ungovernable. A permanent solution based on an international consensus and backing the West was needed, basically to normalise and stabilise the situation. Being a ruling class, of course, you know, they're there to represent the interests of a ruling class. And what ruling classes need is a stable, peaceful environment and society in order to get on with the job what they do, and that's accumulate capital. All right, this is why they need peace. It isn't out of any kind of humanitarian concern, either for Israeli workers or for Palestinians. It's to normalise the trade process and the processes of capitalist society. So they realised that this was in order. What were they to do? Unfortunately, the Likud party, who had been in power from 77 onwards, as well throughout the 80s, had been pouring scorn upon the main representatives of the Palestinians, the PLO. However, they realised that in order to gain this normalisation, they would need another bourgeois faction on the other side to deal with. This is where the PLO comes in, basically. This is the PLO's main function within this area. They are a ruling class in waiting, like a lot of these so-called national liberation movements and groups. More or less like Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, to be honest. They fulfil the same function. And of course, within the Palestinian community, the PLO, by the late 80s, by the time the first Intifada was being fought between 87 and 92, they badly needed legitimisation and stabilisation of their own position. At that point, they were in trouble. The first Intifada was basically a spontaneous uprising within the occupied territories against the draconian military ordinances and appalling living conditions that were being implied, being imposed by the Israelis throughout this period. It wasn't organised, contrary to popular belief, it wasn't organised and it wasn't backed by the PLO at all. The PLO at this point were still in exile in, I think, Tunisia. That's where they were based after they were driven out of Lebanon in the early 80s. So the PLO were in serious trouble. They were in serious they were in the position of serious trouble where they were going to be seen as not the legitimate leaders of the Palestinian cause. There was this uprising on the ground. There's also a direct leadership challenge, of course, from other groups that are now emerging, Islamist groups such as Islamic Jihad and Hamas, who were causing a serious challenge to people like Arafat and their legitimacy. So this stabilisation of the situation was needed just as much by the PLO as it was by a large faction of the Israeli ruling class. What were they to put up with? Well, anything, basically. Anything that would legitimate their position. I think that a lot of members of the PLO, a lot of Fatah, know that they'll never have a fully functioning independent Palestinian state, for reasons which I'll go into later on. However, some kind of a statelet, at least some little bit of power to them, is better than nothing. They can garner a lot of revenue that way. They can legitimate their own position. They can be given, and as they have under the Oslo agreements, security apparatuses and so on. This is going to basically increase their hegemonic position over the Palestinian working class as well. So it is in their interest, no matter what they rhetorically say or have said in the past about Israel, the state of Israel. It's as much in their interest as it is in anyone else's to come to some sort of arrangement. And thirdly, of course, the United States wants stability within the region. If you've got an openly rebellious section of the population right next door to its own ally within the region, obviously this isn't healthy. What imperial interests in this region crave for above all else is, of course, stability, as we all know. This is why they backed Saddam Hussein in Iraq, for example, for so long, and now want a more sort of stable Ba'athist leadership, basically, within Iraq. And this is probably topics for some of the other talks rather than this one. But it just to use a general illustrative point, stability is all for imperial concerns. It's no good having open warfare and insurrections in an area where you're trying to extract oil and thereby, of course, sort of surplus value and profit from. So we can see that some kind of settlement within the area is in the interest of all the major bourgeois players within the area. We'll go over that again. Most of the mainstream Israeli bourgeoisie, the PLO, and of course the Americans. However, trying to set up an independent Palestinian state comes with its own contradictions and its own problems for all these groups, basically. First of all, on the Palestinian side, basically, the situation within the occupied territories now is an awful lot worse than it was 12, 15 years ago. there's a lot less revenue to be had. After the Gulf War, you'll remember that Arafat and the PLO backed Saddam Hussein. Bad move, basically, on his part. This made the PLO momentarily pariahs about 12 years ago. Basically, also what it meant was within after the conclusion of the first Gulf War, in a lot of Gulf states where you have Palestinian workers who were earning pretty good money, being engineers, teachers, and so forth, and were sending remittances back to their families within the occupied territories, a lot of this work was actually cut off. So what you have for a lot of Palestinian people on the ground was an even further cut in their already pretty meagre standards of living as this revenue from outside was cut. So, of course, you know, this is going to fuel discontent within the occupied territories themselves, thus making the Palestinian working class a lot harder to control from the point of view of the PLO. Also, within the occupied territories as well, over the last 10, 15 years, you've had a further acceleration of the process of capitalism going into all spheres of life. As with quite a few places in the Middle East and in Africa, you still have had basically peasants, small-scale producers, holding on for dear life in certain parts of the area, certainly within within the Palestinian areas. But this has largely been wiped out over the last 10 to 15 years. I mean, for example, there was a large milk factory which was built near a place called Churar by a joint Israeli and Palestinian initiative. Basically, what this did was it had the effect of wiping out a lot of small independent milk-producing farmers, peasant farmers, within the Palestinian areas. This one factory accounts now for about 20% of all the milk output in the occupied territories, for example. This dispossessed an awful lot of small-scale farmers, increasing, you know, what we know historically, the process of proletarianisation, to coin a long and complicated phrase. But what that means is people moving off land and small holdings into urban areas, having to become wage workers. That's all it's a fancy term for. But what this does is this has created an even larger dispossessed poor mass within the Palestinian territories. And of course, the third major factor that's added to the deterioration of the economic situation within the occupied territories is, of course, the building of Israeli settlements. Now, this has been going on since at least 67, but I mean, this has actually been accelerated in the last 10 to 15 years, particularly with the onset of the Oslo peace accords. Obviously, if a lot of land is lost, and it is lost, it's usually just seized. The people who owned it before don't get any compensation whatsoever. Obviously, you are increasing a large immiserated population in an even smaller and smaller and constricted area. If you actually know how a lot of these settlements are set up, roads are actually built to Israel proper, which of course usually cut through even more Palestinian land. And what there is in the occupied territories is being carved up and cantonized more and more and more, being crisscrossed by these roads, which the Israeli army demands direct access and control over. So what this is doing is this is contributing and helping accelerate the process of immiseration of the large part of the Palestinian population. Now, there's a flip side to this as well. Living conditions within Israel proper themselves have been plummeting since 1967. As you'll probably know, Israel is one of the more advanced social democratic states in the world. In fact, it's one of the things that they've often prided themselves on, especially the Israeli Labour Party. However, you've had all sorts of problems within Israel proper. Like every other country, it's had to open itself up to neoliberal reforms and to all that entails. So that means basically an attack and a lowering on social services, for example. It means that people have to accept casualisation in work, lower wages, etc., etc. And of course, this is not without its discontents within Israeli society proper. Israelis are obviously a lot more fortunate than the average Palestinian worker in this respect, in that they have unions and a functioning sort of civil society that they can refer sort of grievances to, although this isn't usually the case. The Israeli bourgeoisie, of course, is pretty much in favour of normalisation of trade relations with other Arab bourgeoisies. This means that they can become a lot more potentially independent with an economic base in the Middle East itself, rather than relying on trade with Europe or the United States. Quite a bit of Israeli revenue, for example, is earned through diamond trade, but that's obviously, you know, reliant not only on diamond producing areas in South Africa and the rest of Africa, but with mainland Europe, and particularly historically Belgium, for the trade in diamonds for one reason or another. Of course, Israel, as we all know, is heavily reliant on the United States, both formally in terms of its aid package and its military provision, but it's also in terms of its overall balance of trade and so forth. So, I mean, I think the Israeli bourgeoisie needs some kind of stabilisation within the area, and it needs to restructure its whole post 1967 settlement. What do I mean by that? Well, as I'm sure we're all aware, a social democratic settlement is essentially one way of buying the acquiescence of a working class within a certain society. You give people certain guaranteed wages, benefits, etc., etc. It basically has the effect of attempting to kill off class conflict and radicalise demands. This is no longer possible for the Israelis. As I said, living standards within the state of Israel proper have been falling. At the same time, particularly since the end of the Cold War, you've had an influx of population into Israel proper from former Eastern Europe. These people have to be given work, they have to live somewhere. Hence, where do you go? Well, they go into the occupied territories to build these settlements up. So as you can see, what's going on essentially is a vicious circle. Israel needs to physically expand its infrastructure. This means more and more dispossession of the Palestinian areas, which of course in turn leads to even further immiseration of the Palestinian population, which will obviously lead to more and more discontent, violence. And it's basically this process that I see as fueling the current intifada, this vicious downward spiral, as it were, of which both ruling classes now seem to be in a bit of a pickle as to how they're actually going to solve it all. Now, as I said earlier on, Ariel Sharon was re-elected in the beginning of 2001, I think. This isn't just about personalities, I would say. I think that what you're beginning to have in Israel now is that that kind of consensus that went along with the peace process, that people like Shimon Peres began to back initially, I think that consensus that there must be some kind of settlement with the Palestinians is basically beginning to break down through the needs of Israeli capital that I just expressed. Hence, somebody like Sharon and the right wing of the Likud party can get back in and basically hold more or less a sort of a stranglehold on political power. Sharon, as I'm sure many of you know, is actually in favour of the greater Israeli project. He's really hawkish. He's actually in favour of creating a greater Israel. In the past, he's actually said that he thinks the borders of Israel should not just stretch down as they did after the Six Days War to the Suez Canal. He also believes that Israel should basically control the southernmost 40 or 50 miles or so of what's now Lebanon, straight up to Beirut. He basically believes that a lot of the land beyond the Golan Heights into Syria ought to be direct Israeli territory. He believes basically in absorbing most of the West Bank to within Israel proper, the so-called fabled biblical borders of Israel. Sharon in particular has in the past, I know that he's not careful to do it now, but in the past, not only has he referred to Arabs in... Basically, he's called them animals who walk on two legs. Now, he's used essentially openly racist terms towards Arabs, but he also believes that there already is a Palestinian state and it's called Jordan, and all Palestinians should basically be removed into the Kingdom of Jordan and should basically really have nothing to do with Israel itself. So that's Sharon. You know, unfortunately, he's up against the pragmatic needs in the region of the Americans. Their need for stability. They basically want some kind of solution. And of course, there's the tensions within Israeli capital itself. What they need, basically, are an immiserized, unempowered Palestinian population, just on their border. Maybe not under their direct control, because that's going to require that they become full citizens of Israel. But what they needed, of course, is a pool of cheap labor for the Israeli economy in general. So there's a massive contradiction here, one that I don't think within the context of capitalism is going to really ever be able to be solved, and it's just going to lead to more immiseration and more conflict as the years go on. So that's my take on the peace process and what's actually going on behind the current intifada. I've still got about 10 minutes or so, I think what I'd like to explore is what various left-wing groups say about this situation. Essentially, it falls into two camps from what I can see. On the one hand, you have groups like the Socialist Workers' Party, who basically call for a democratic socialist state within the area. There's another group which favours a two-state solution, which actually favours the establishment of a full Palestinian state. There's groups like the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, Weekly Worker, who back this kind of solution. Both, I think, are fatally flawed. The first position, the SWP position, has been around for many years in various guises. As I said, they call for what they term as a democratic socialist state. Obviously, as we know, the very notion of a socialist state is in and of itself oxymoronic. However, I think what they're doing is, this is a good Leninist position, and they're basically showing how they function as a left-wing of capital rather than actually a revolutionary socialist group in this respect. Basically, the SWP believes and calls for in inverted commas, a socialist revolution in the area led by radicalised Arab states within the general region. Basically, what they're calling for is one kind of revolution or another in the nearby Arab states, in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan, in Syria, and in Egypt. And basically what they're essentially calling for is, after this, for a resumption of the Six Days War. Essentially, they're calling for an invasion of Israel, the destruction of the state of Israel, and then apparently this secular, democratic, socialist state will be set up as if by magic. Of course, I mean, really, if I have to go into the flaws of this, which I think are glaringly obvious to most of us here, but I will do. First of all, who's going to lead this war against the state of Israel? Well, they may be harking back to some kind of call for radical pan-Arabic nationalism, such as was around in the days of Nasser, which I think would probably be, if you asked the average sort of member of the SWP, would probably be their preferred option if they thought about that, or indeed if they think in depth about anything. But of course, this has been long dead and long discredited. This political tendency is dead in the water. It no longer exists. A lot of the Arab bourgeoisies are inextricably tied to the West in one way or another. And a lot of the secular Arab forces in this way have shrunk. They've become minuscule. What it means in practice, and what it's more likely to mean, is actually a backing for a generalised Islamic revolution in the Middle East. And what they want to see is a radicalised Islamic movement, fundamentalist Islamic movement, basically overrunning the state of Israel. Well, do I really have to go into this? There's two main glaring errors and flaws in this. First of all, you're condemning the entire Israeli population as reactionary, basically as irredeemably Zionist, as somehow different from workers everywhere else in the world. You know, apparently, if you believe in socialism, you believe that working class can emancipate itself, you know. But apparently Israeli workers can't get ideas about socialism. They have no inherent feelings of solidarity with other human beings. You know, this is nonsense, and actually I think, although the SWP isn't actually an explicitly anti-Semitic organisation, I think that people could take
broad anti-Semitic ideas from this sort of stance, as indeed some of their activists on campus do. I believe at King's College, for example, that there's been people who've been calling for an end to the Jewish Society at King's College. Not, of course, that I'm in favour of any kind of religious society at all, but I believe in freedom of expression and freedom of worship. This is appalling, and it shows that the kind of alliances that these people are prepared to make just to get supporters or whatever. Secondly, of course, as I've said, this actually means in the area that you're not going to get some kind of Soviet-style, secular democratic revolution in the Middle East. You're actually going to have an Islamic fundamentalist revolution. If you look at what happened to the likes of us in Iran during the Iranian Revolution in 1980, you'll pretty much see what Islamic fundamentalists would want to do with the likes of us. I mean, we'd be killed or exiled. And basically, that would probably include Trotskyist groups as well, as it did in Iran. If I was a religious man, in a way, I'm not, but I'd almost say it's like dealing with the devil. Not that I'm implying that everyone who's a Muslim is a servant of Satan or whatever. Of course, I'm not. But if you team up with Islamic fundamentalists, you are going to get it in the neck, essentially. They see us and secular Democrats, socialists, communists, whatever, as just as bad as the people that they're trying to overthrow. So it's completely an untenable position, I think. Secondly, there's a possibly a more... I'm keeping an eye on the time. A more reasoned, slightly more sophisticated point of view. Groups like the AWL put across a call for a two-state solution. Well, as I've already said, I don't think, for various reasons which can possibly go into in the discussion, that a fully functioning Palestinian state is at all viable. Given the level of dispossession of the very infrastructure within the occupied territories, I just don't think it's viable. The Israelis, for example, ship most of the water out of the occupied territories, let alone oil. Another big resource that you have conflicts over in this area is water. A lot of Palestinian farming concerns just can't get enough water to grow crops, basically. There's not enough money there to basically provide proper infrastructure like roads, let alone a fully functioning state with education, health services, and all the rest that entails. Secondly, it means backing, unlike the SWP, who just back one bourgeois faction, they actually call for backing two bourgeois factions, right? You've got to back the accommodationist side of the Israeli bourgeoisie on the one hand, and on the other hand, you've got to back the PLO and Arafat and the emerging Palestinian bourgeoisie, who are completely corrupt, it has to be said. What does the Palestinian Authority spend all its money on? There's one policeman for every 30 Palestinians. They spend it completely on security apparatus. They do things like punishment killings and beatings of activists who have opposed them. They've been doing that over the years. During the first Intifada, a lot of people were actually killed as so-called collaborationists, particularly around the city of Tal Karim in the West Bank. Basically, what this was PLO and its arm wing, basically going around killing people that it didn't that were its political opponents. So let's not have any great illusions as to what the PLO and the emerging Palestinian bourgeoisie are like. And of course, thirdly, this idea that you're going to create two states, to my mind, further entrenches nationalism within the minds of people in the area. I'd like to know how you're going to get an international solution when you're actually promoting virulent nationalism and forming new nation states on both sides. I just don't see how that would work. I actually see that as a step backwards. I think what you should be doing as socialists is creating class consciousness, internationalized consciousness, not national consciousness. So I think for all these reasons, both of these perspectives are flawed. And not only that, I think they demonstrate the great flaw in the Leninist approach to national liberation struggles. They're about backing fractions of the bourgeoisie rather than backing the working class. Again, maybe that's something we can go into in discussions later on. So very, very quickly in the last couple of minutes, what can we do as members of the World Socialist Movement or its supporters or sympathisers? Well, first of all, we don't actually have any members of any of our companion parties on the ground. So maybe anything I will say will be speculative. Critics of an internationalist response, moreover on the left, say that calls for working class unity between Palestinians and Israelis are just that, just abstract calls. There's no real substance to them. Well, I disagree with that, and I disagree for the following reasons, and I think these are steps that we can take to show our support and develop a critique of what's going on in the area. First of all, I think what we can do is we can engage in activity the SPGB has been very good at in the past, in fact probably what we're famous for, and that's encouraging conscientious objection within the area. The SPGB, of course, encouraged and organised conscientious objection through both world wars. And there's a small but growing number of Israelis who are refusing to serve in the armed forces within Israel. I think we can give them as much moral support. We should give them as much moral support as we can. Sorry, I'm choking up a bit because I haven't got any water. I will finish in a bit. Secondly, we can provide an ongoing critique of Zionism and the current situation within Israel itself. Thirdly, we can continue to critique the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, and the radical Islam movements and the whole notion of Islamic religious fundamentalism in the first place. And of course, we can begin to build on what I hope we did today and critique the various approaches that left-wing organisations have made and to come up with our own perspective. And lastly, what I've got written down here is that, to coin a phrase from Paris in 1968, we should be realistic and demand the impossible. Ramsay MacDonald called the SPGB impossibilists. He was trying to use this as a term of political abuse towards us. Actually, we take it on with pride, and we actually call ourselves the impossibilist tendency. Hence, I think that's a fine phrase for us to adapt. Material circumstances, as I think I've demonstrated, tend to point to Israeli and Palestinian workers identifying with their own national sides within this conflict, rather than seeing capitalism as the enemy, as the opponents. What we need to do, of course, is to develop and promote an internationalist class conscious point of view and perspective on this, which is, of course, entirely what we're trying to do when we talk about building up the world socialist movement. Class conflict in the area, generalised class conflict, will increase as the struggle is generalised within the area. What you have to realise is that there is a growing trend towards proletarianisation within the Middle East itself. And so when the post-67 settlement breaks down within Israel, you will see a wider immiseration of the working class throughout the Middle East. I think this opens up possibilities for a genuine internationalist response across national borders. The war on terrorism, as Bush has declared, is going to be an international struggle. I think therefore it demands and opens up the possibility of an internationalised response. I think in the case of the Middle East, this is badly needed. Otherwise, the area is going to sink into even more turmoil, even more immiseration, and even more violence. I think it's the only way out of the cycle. I'll hand it over to you guys now.